Welcome to Valhalla Conversations Podcast. I'm your host, Becky Hill, otherwise known as Soul Chaser Becky, and I am a proud Viking geek. I fell in love with the history, culture, and mythology of the Viking Age, and I have been on an endless quest for more ever since. Join me as I discuss all things Norse with those who have been inspired by Viking Age history and Norse mythology in their creative works, or those who have studied the sagas and archaeology, and review how such subjects are being presented to modern audiences today. If you like Viking stuff, you are welcome in my Valhalla, and I hope you stay for the conversation. Welcome everyone to Valhalla Conversations Podcast in episode 12. This is a special group panel review of Twilight of the Gods, an animated series on Netflix, which introduces you to Thor and Loki in a very non-Marvel-esque way. It's refreshingly bold, quite brutal and savage, and full of blood and gore, and there is sex as well, so it's definitely not for 16s under, definitely 18s and over, I would recommend. And I am delighted to say I'm joined by two returning guests and a new one in my humble mead hall of my little geeky Valhalla, which is Valhalla Conversations. So we shall introduce Caroline, Sasha and Kim. And Caroline, if you'd like to introduce yourself and your wonderful works, please.
Hello, I'm Caroline Larrington and I am a retired professor of medieval European literature from the University of Oxford. I've written quite a lot about Old Norse myth over the last 40 years or so, and I haven't stopped yet. And I've become increasingly interested in Old Norse medievalism, what happens to Old Norse myth in contemporary culture, and that's what I'm working on a lot at the moment.
Brilliant, thank you. I'm glad you could be joining with us again for what is your second episode with me today. It's because we've had previous incarnations in MCM Comic Con, which is how this all wonderful started. Yes, that's what gave me the buzz to do this thing. So thank you, Caroline, for being part of that journey. Sasha, could you introduce yourself and your many wonderful works?
Yeah, I'm Sasha from Slightly Reckless Games. We're a TTRPG company based in the UK. We started by making a kind of dark fantasy samurai inspired TTRPG, and then last year we kickstarted a Norse mythology based TTRPG called Berserker. So I'm nowhere near as esteemed as the other two guests, but I can certainly talk about it from that point of view. That's us.
Brilliant. Welcome. And of course, I will definitely be getting Sasha on in a future episode later in the year, ladies and gentlemen and folks listening and watching, to talk about his Berserker TTRPG, because I have thrown money at it. So I'm looking forward to getting all the wonderful goodies in the Kickstarter and then trying to find space on my very full bookshelves to fit it on. So thank you. I'm glad you could join us today. And of course, Kim, who is another familiar face to people who've been following the podcast so far, could you please remind everyone of your wonderful works?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm Kim Barton, and I write under the name K.S. Barton. I'm the author of the Norse Family Trilogy, a story in which a young Viking woman and a Viking warrior are caught in a deadly blood feud between two families. I typically write historical fiction and fantasy set in the Viking Age, and so far I've written six novels in which I like to explore themes of family, honor, and strength within this Norse mythology, Norse society. I also co-host the podcast Shield Maidens, Women of the Norse World. And I have an MA in humanities, and I just really love to learn about history through stories, my own stories and other people's stories. So I love studying stuff like this, like that, what we're going to do, just to see how everything turns out.
Oh. Brilliant. Well, I'm glad you could join us again. And of course, please do go check out her wonderful podcast, Shield Maidens, Women of the Norse World, which presents with Johanna Wittenberg as well. It's really fascinating. Lots of amazing topics and stories of amazing women, both mythological and historical, they cover. And their last episode with Nancy Marine Brown was amazing. I really, really enjoyed that one.
Yeah, it was great to talk to her.
So, Twilight of the Gods on Netflix. Now, I remember coming across this, ironically enough, when I was in Norway and I was happened to be in the lovely company of Caroline Larrington at my debut academic appearance, at a symposium in Stavanger. And I remember sharing the trailer with Caroline, and we're both like, what are they doing? Because it seemed very, it was so outlandish. We couldn't quite work out what they were doing, let alone what
it
they
was very
doing.
Sweary, wasn't it?
It was. They hit the 18 mark.
In the hall of the Barnet, going, are we allowed to swear on this?
You can. I don't have a bleeper, but okay, I believe adults mainly listen to my episodes.
Okay, well, I was going to say, I'll probably swear without thinking about it.
The main figures all going, cool, we're going to go and kill some fucking gods. And I was like, really? Right, okay. This is not Disney, clearly.
Not even Marvel, yes.
I think. I know, but actually, there's a dragon as well. So they're going to have to kill the dragon as well as going to kill the gods, because they've got to go and get the apples, isn't it? We're going to kill a fucking dragon.
Yes, I'm going to kill a fucking dragon, says Anvari the dwarf. I think I remember that preview trailer had the words kind of like blood, sex, and Vikings or something along that line. Definitely had blood, the word sex, popping up in that preview trailer from what I remember. And there is a lot of it. There's a lot of both. Fair to say.
There was a lot of gore.
There is. It's thankfully all animated, but it's very visual. Very, very visual. But not, I mean, I've seen more grotesque things in other mainly Japanese anime series which do dive deep into many taboo subjects. But anyway, so as I mentioned at the start, this presents a very what I call refreshingly bold and brave in many ways take on two of the canon that many people are familiar with, which is of course Thor and Loki. And so we'll start off with the big guy in the room with a hammer, which is Thor. Who would like to share their thoughts on his depiction, portrayal, and story arc through the series?
I'll start. So I didn't have any issue with Thor being the bad guy. That retelling, because I feel like this is mythology and these are stories, and stories evolve and change and different people see things in different ways. That I didn't have an issue with that, but I did. He was so overpowered in the first episode, and then later that was gone. Like, and that kind of bugged me. I had an issue with that because in that first episode, he was just like, I don't know, just blowing the giants up with his lightning. And then later on when he was fighting with Sigrid one-on-one, he didn't do any of that kind of stuff or any of the subsequent fights with Sigrid and her crew. It felt like he just lost a lot of his power. And I had a little bit of an issue with that.
Maybe he was holding back a bit.
That's what I got the impression of, yeah.
Yeah, that he's got... I don't know what we're going to do about spoilers here, but...
Sorry, yes. Dear listeners, there will be spoilers because there's only 8 episodes and it's only season 1. We don't know yet, or at least I don't know yet, if there will be a season 2, especially with the way they ended season 1, which we'll get to. So, yes, sorry. Spoiler warning. I apologise. Spoiler warning. Sorry. Carry on, Caroline.
Yeah, well, I think what you could see was that Sigrid, at least, even if some of the other characters didn't have plot armour, and so you couldn't have a situation where Thor was just going to blow her up with some lightning because, right, yeah, end of story. And so there was a kind of part of the mechanism for making it possible to have season 2 was taking Thor out of what we were kind of led to believe was the final battle, was going to be Ragnarok, and putting him in Valhalla, where it's going to turn up later on. So it seemed as if there was some other power that was, and I think that Kim's absolutely right here, there's some other power. Is it the fates? Is it the Norns? Something that's holding him back from just unleashing all that crazy stuff that we saw in episode 1.
Yeah. I also got the impression as well, like, if you'd believe what kind of Balder says to Sif about him kind of wanting to be mortal and to die, that maybe he's kind of holding back for that reason as well, as in a case of you know, someone's actually challenging him on a kind of physical level that he isn't used to. But from a game development point of view, that, as you say, that first episode kind of changed my design of Thor in our game. It was like, I was like, no, he has to feel kind of that powerful, which is a hard line to toe in a game, because it's like, you don't want him to be undefeatable as like, you know, as an antagonist for the players. But I gave him some kind of more abilities that mirrored that first episode. So he had something where he deals like damage on like the same kind of scale of like blowing people up. And that.
What I thought was really interesting about that first episode was the way that it positioned you in the point of view of the Giants.
Yes,
who seemed to be, you know, kind of big, lumbering, but actually quite a jolly bunch of people, Sigrid's relatives, and they're all got together, going to have a nice wedding and so on. And then Thor comes in, kind of stomp, stomp, to flatten everybody for no particularly good reason. It's except that's what Thor does mythologically. He kills John. And it made me think we have some myths in which Thor kills the giants because they deserve it, because they've done something antagonistic to the gods. But you've also got this kind of throwaway line in the sense in the myth. So where's Thor? Oh, he's off in the east killing giants. That's what he does. Yeah. And you don't see that close up, and you certainly don't see it from the giant's perspective.
No,
but it reminded me, in a way, a bit of Genevieve Gornicek's The Witch's Heart, which by the time you get to the end of that, you are totally rooting for giants because you've had enough of the gods and their corrupt ways and their annoying little habits. And Joanne Harris already started that, I think, with the Gospel of Loki. Changing the way in which the Aesir were previously thought of as troubled, maybe, with some oath-breaking in their history, but, you know, basically the good guys. And from the get-go with episode one, you think the Aesir are not the good guys here. And I understand that that's something that may come out of God of War, that positioning of the Aesir as an oppressive order that really needs to be overthrown. So I was really taken aback by this, but then I thought, okay, that seems to be what the pedigree is.
I must admit, for me personally, yes, Thor was grotesquely powerful, dominating, and just outright cruel, basically, with the fact that he didn't even really fight the giants. He just used his hammer like a gun and just zapped them all to death, which was almost a bit lazy, really. He didn't even hit them with the head, which is what he's canonically known to do. But it also made me think that they've taken the Lay of Thrym set up and completely twisted it. So instead of, because of course Thor and Balder come looking for Loki, we never told or hinted at what Loki's done to make Thor hunt him down like this. And I'm thinking maybe they're taking the end, like just before Loki gets bound, when he is running away from Thor at all opportunities. Maybe that's alluded to. But yes, that made me think, because of course there is a giant wedding in that one, and Loki and Thor are part of that canonical legend where they go in disguise, Thor in a wedding dress, Loki shapeshifting into a beautiful bridesmaid, and eventually he just gets his hammer out and kill everyone, unfortunately. So I thought that was maybe a really interesting twist on that. But as you say, it does put you brilliantly at the opposite end of seeing Thor not as the good god, the guy that gives us rain and helps the crops grow and gives us wonderful lightning shows in the sky, but as the god of violence that he often exerts in the legends and the Eddas and so on. But of course, we meet Thor quite halfway through the episode after meeting Sigrid, who is one of the protagonists. She is a shield maiden, but of half giant heritage. We also meet her partner, King to be, Leif, who is of the Volsung family, which I thought, oh, what are they doing with the Volsungs? Where is that going? And again, after rewatching it a second time, there isn't much of the canon of the Volsung. It just seems to be a nice name to give credit to it all. She herself has another shield maiden friend called Hervor. Now, Hervor is another shield maiden taken from legend, mainly the Cursed Sword of Tirfing, which I actually had the good position of seeing performed dramatically at the Orbit Viking Festival only last week, which was amazing. And there's so many other characters, but when Sigrid and Leif go to meet the giant kind, we learn from Sigrid's father that they have had a past quabble or a war with the gods, and they're spit sworn. I love the dialogue. They've got spit sworn, they've got kennings, nearly everything in this series. Like an oath, and it takes kind of like Leif to give them the Volsung Hall to persuade them that actually, yeah, we'll make an oath with you so we don't go and kill you, seeing you now like my daughter, kind of thing. But Loki does emerge by the end of season one. He introduces himself in quite dramatic style down in his daughter's kingdom of Hel. And Hel herself has horns. Now, this is actually going on to another point. Having rewatched it a second time, I was surprised to actually see that there are horned helmets in this series. I thought, oh, we have a series that horns, but no, in the battle that Sigrid and Leif meet at, the bad army has horned helmets. But then also near the end of the series where they're all fighting in front of Valhalla, all of Valhalla's soldiers have horned helmets. Again, it's the motif that we can't escape from, but is recognisably Viking, so we shall let it lie. But yes, so that was thought. And as you say about him being overpowering and not being as powerful by the end, and of course, Sasha, you mentioned about Sif and Baldur's conversation about maybe he has an issue with being immortality. Maybe he's tired of it. Maybe he just wants putting out into pasture and being shot effectively, as my father would say, kind of thing. I think that was a real nice touch that they actually kind of explored beneath his like big masculinity issues. She's always kind of like demeaning Sif about her sexual ability and going off with another woman slash goddess who I've got no idea where she's come from at all, and I will ask you all about that in a minute. But I thought that was a real nice issue, because is it nice to be a god? Is it nice to be divine and to live forever and have all this power but then see anything? I don't know if any had any more thoughts about those issues that were explored through Thor and his possible vulnerabilities underneath it all that drives this aggression, this rage, this violence.
That conversation, I'd forgotten about that conversation, but it reminded me, like, and I'll say this about the entire show, it was very, very much inspired by the Lord of the Rings movies. There were so many scenes, some of the music, certain things that were very, I just kept going, that was inspired by the Peter Jackson movies. That was inspired by the Peter Jackson movies, just the way it was filmed. But that conversation that they had also reminded me of Tolkien and the way that his elves can become world weary, that they get tired of being immortal, and they'll sometimes just go off to die because it's just exhausting to be immortal. And I don't remember if it was Elrond in the books or who it was. It's been a while since I've actually read the books, but one of the elves talked about the gift of mortality that mortal men have, that it's a gift to be mortal, because then you can like burn brightly and rather than this kind of slow diminishing that happens to the elves. So that conversation between Sif and Baldur reminded me very much of Tolkien's beliefs about immortality.
Yeah, I think it's Elrond that tells.
Is it
Arwen when he's because she wants to be mortal? I think. Well, no, she wants to marry Aragorn, doesn't she? And he's explaining that he's mortal, so you'll outlive them all. But I thought it was interesting with coming back to the Thor and his kind of Baldur saying that he, you know, envies mortals, that it kind of spoke about that, and they had that scene. But then I think it was like either the episode or maybe two episodes prior where he's just kind of wrestling with his son, and his son kind of pushes him back while he's distracted and he, you know, lashes out.
Bad parenting there. Just straight bad parenting. And see that he only has one son, because of course in the lore he has twins, does he not, Caroline?
Not necessarily twins, but certainly he's got sons. And that moment where it's clear that his son, small as he is stronger Father is something that we find in Skull Scarpamowl in one of the bits of the Prose Edda. Thor has managed to topple the giant Hrungnir, who's huge and has this head made of stone, which makes him extra heavy, I guess. And Hrungnir falls over Thor, and Thor is trapped under his leg. And so he's kind of lying there. Yeah, I imagine kind of waving like a beetle. And his son Magni comes along and lifts the leg up and goes, "There you are, Dad." And Thor gets up and kind of, and it's one of those moments where you can see how the next generation is beginning to come into its own. And why we know why Thor isn't going to be there after Ragnarok because of the World Serpent, but Magni and Modi, his two sons, are. And so you can see that that kind of, that power is still vested, maybe more, maybe a couple of more moral kids, who knows. But it continues when the world is renewed again.
Very interesting to learn that. I did not know about that one. Okay, so switching from Thor to Loki then, who of course reveals himself at the end of episode one and declares to Sigrid after dragging her through corpse blood through the earth all the way to hell. What a lovely way to go. Even without her clothes, I thought, you could the poor lass not keep a dress on, but no. She says kind of like, oh, good thing you get a taste for blood because I want to give you Thor's. And of course, he does introduce himself as Loki, Laufey's son, and she actually challenges him, I believe. Sigrid challenges him, like, kind of like, if you're a kin of giants, why were you not there to stop Thor slaughtering my entire family on my wedding day? Which is interesting. So Loki, he is definitely, he's got the smooth charisma. I guess you could say that's recognisable. It is a firm fixture that a lot of interpretations have presented Loki as having. But he also seems to have not just his shape-shifting ability, but also an ulterior motive that isn't just about causing mayhem and problems for the gods and then having to fix the problems that he then makes, because it does emerge as the episodes reveal, especially one particular episode, which I absolutely loved, which was the scapegoat god, that he's doing it all in order to protect his children, which I think is a wonderful twist to the Loki characteristic of not just wanting to burn the world because he hates what the gods have done to his children, but trying to protect them regardless of what the gods are trying to do.
Was that the episode at the beginning where Angerboda gives birth to Hel and Thor shows up to get rid of him, and he explains what's going to happen to all three? Is that
episode? That's in the scapegoat god. Yeah, that's where him and Leif are stuck in Honia's head, which is
fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, right. Okay.
And they're just getting flashbacks of memories and the regret and the woe that weighs them all down and is meant to make them basically never leave and trapped in that insane part of a magical universe, I suppose. But yes, that was an interesting take, I thought, especially kind of like having Hel not just be half linear or vertically dead and alive, but literally shapeshift from being dead to alive, albeit having horns, which I will try not to keep picking on. But I quite liked that. And of course, Jormungandr, his typically a son in the lore and the legends, but it's depicted as a female. She can shapeshift from either the giant snake in the sea or being a scaled figure with short hair, and she decides to get in bed with Thor, basically, by causing a shipwreck, which was an interesting way of luring him as it emerged through later episodes. How and why they do that, I'm not entirely sure. Even after a second rewatching, it seems to be hinted that it's in order to keep them alive, even though Loki knows, well, even if you do go to bed with Thor, he's still going to kill you, although you will kill him, or something along those lines.
Well, it's a kind of love and death thing, isn't it? Because there's that moment in Heimskvither where, oh no, actually it's in one of the Skaldic verses, I think, where Thor goes out on the fishing expedition with the giant Hymir, and he hauls up the world serpent. And there's this moment where they're looking at each other. And you can see there how there's this kind of attraction that our fates are bound together, and that can end up as I will kill you, or and you will kill me, or it can end up as we will have sex together at some point. Just not now, obviously, in the middle of this rowing boat in the ocean. But I thought that was quite clever to make that bond not between them, that fated bond, not just, yeah, you're my doom. Sooner or later, we're going to have to face this out when actual Ragnarok actually comes. But to get that going before. And the idea that Loki's own shape-shifting goes down into the children as well is really clever. Actually, I don't remember if Fenrir shapeshifts, does
he? Nope, he was a pup, and then he's just a giant pair of big blue eyes in the gloom. That's all we see of him in his giant form. And only a brief glimpse of him as a giant wolf with Odin, and he is a whole other complex character, or not, depending on how deep you look into him, because he actually had a very brief appearance in this whole saga of events, because it's pretty much like just a triangle of warfare and conflicts between Sigrid, Loki and Thor, and how many times it can go around. But what else do you guys think about Loki's character and story arc?
Well, he seemed to me to be, there were, you could see Tom Hiddleston kind of hovering behind him a bit, I think. And Patterson Joseph, who voices him, has got, it's not the same voice as Hiddleston, but he's got that kind of smooth voice that Hiddleston can do when he's not wisecracking. He can do smooth very nicely, I think. And I thought Loki was doing exactly what I expected him to do until exactly that scapegoat god. Where, for me, that was kind of where the show stopped being quite so, here's a game derived plot. Here's a big set piece battle, biff, bash, bosh. Here's another one. Here's some special effects. Here's some more sex. Here's people doing weird things with their bodies. And it's where it started really getting psychological. Obviously, in Hainir's head.
Yes.
You got a lot of important information about backstory, and you got Leif suddenly feeling guilt and something a bit like remorse about his Viking career.
Yes, I thought that was another really interesting take about whether any Viking actually came back from a raid and regretted killing loads of families and children and then taking them into slavery. I thought, because as much as humanity has an inept ability for cruelty as well as creativity and all the good things we can do, we have this cruel streak, but can anyone really be one way or the other? Kind of like, yeah, it was a really interesting take I quite liked. But yes, the scapegoat god I thought was really, really good, and especially when kind of like Leif says, but it's all you, Loki, you do all these things, and Loki goes, no, man made me what I am. Every boy who didn't make his bed that morning or something, something really benign like that, whereas I've got loads of notes of quotes. Loads of quotes. Where is it?
While you're looking for that, I love the visual of Loki. I love his hair and the way they designed his face and everything. I really liked. I liked the visuals of him and yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad. I thought he was really refreshingly well done. He looked distinctly different as well as Freya did, because she was a Vanir, so they really showed the differences, that they weren't just all homogeneously one type of person, type of race. Their differences really shone through. Sticking with the Loki theme, when Loki meets Freya, and I really like that it was her big cat that caught him as a salamander and carried him all the way through to her hall, she actually asks him kind of like, why do you use your mother's name? And I can't remember which episode it was now. And I believe he says it's because my mum didn't hit me, but my father did, or something along those lines.
But that's in the mythology, right? That he goes by Loki Laufey.
He does, but I really like that that's referenced. I really like that's referenced because not many people realise that they may know kind of like, oh yes, he has his father, was a giant, but many people forget that he did have a mother on the Azir tribe, clan side, kind of thing.
And also in the Marvel universe, his father is called Lofey.
Mm.
And so you hear the name and you think, oh yeah, that's his dad. If you don't know enough Scandinavian to know that's a feminine name. So it was, it marked him out as being different because everybody else is somebody, somebody's son.
Mm.
Except for Loki, who is just identifying down this maternal line.
Mm. I found the quote. Freya says, why do you wear your mother's name? Again, the dialogue. I just love it. I mean, I know it sounds very kind of a Lord of the Rings-esque. It's full of different words that you wouldn't really put in today's vernacular, but I just love the way it sounded. And he says, my father hit me, my mother did not. And then he makes everything really weird by asking if contracts are made in mother's milk. And Frey goes, yes, of course they are. And kind of like she nudges her bosom rather affectionately. And I'm like, really, you're drinking that? And I'm like, okay, this is, it's got weird. But yes, in terms of scapegoat god, Leif says, but you're supposed to be the root of all that's wicked and you cannot accept yourself. And then Loki goes, I am only what men made me. I am the beast of unburdening. And I only exist so men may blame me. I might be a scapegoat god, which I thought is, yeah, that's an interesting way. Kind of like, I remember growing up when we used to get into trouble, kind of like my mum go, oh, so Mr. Nobody did it, did he? Did Mr. Nobody not tidy up the room? And we're like, that immediately connected to that episode of my childhood. And again, blaming something that is beyond our control. And yeah, that is, in effect, Loki. It's like people blame him for all sorts. But interestingly enough, after this great outpouring and opening up of his raw soul, quite literally, to Leif within Honir's head, when they do come out, when they escape with the help of Sigrid and lots of others, he completely changes tack in front of everyone. He announces kind of like he, when Sigrid and Leif saying, oh yes, the Vanir gods, we've given you apples, we're sorry they nearly killed you. That's a whole other episode we'll get to, dear viewers and listeners. Can you please join us in toppling the Azir? But Loki goes, oh, but you would give away my glory. And then he says, I am but a flint the Allfather strikes. I am fire and flame. I am Loki, the loathsome and the blamed. With a sly nod to Leif, and then he vanishes in a puff of magical smoke, very dramatically. And showmanship. And I thought, yes, he's back to his kind of like his persona that he likes to present to everyone. So that moment of weakness that is now just between him and Leif. I don't think he really shows any weaknesses towards Sigrid in any particular aspect. But yes, I really liked how it emerged. And even on the battlefield at the end, actually, when Sigrid and Leif are talking after just about evading a big explosion that Thor caused by hitting the ground really hard with his hammer and sending literally everyone flying in the air and obliterating everything. Kind of like he goes, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And then she realizes, oh, it's to protect your family. At least your family are alive. I'm trying to fight for dead family, kind of thing. Yeah. And of course, the brilliant line that I think was used a lot in the trailers in promotion for this was kind of like a god killing a god. That comes and goes, but a mortal killing a god, that's enough to remake the world. And I just, absolutely, yes, it's challenging the status quo from top to bottom, actually having the bottom come up and literally top all the top off quite figuratively in a brilliant way. But I will stop nattering and let you guys have some of the floor. Any other thoughts on Loki?
I thought that episode did a good job of kind of humanizing him a little bit, because I think it's quite easy. Yeah, I think I don't know how manipulative he'd been up to that point, but it seemed to humanize him a little bit. But I did appreciate that kind of, I think it might have been the episode after that he kind of bursts Andvari's head
for, oh, yes,
kind of, which seemed unnecessarily brutal. But I don't know if that was kind of more of a reaction to, you know, he'd kind of shown himself a little bit, and then that was him just going, no, I'm still, you know, still Loki.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. That was a surprise death I did not see coming. But then I guess that's very much Loki in a way, tying up all the loose ends. because before that they get into that citadel in Asgard, we have that episode of Now Here Of, where they all have a brilliant storytelling episode.
Which again, a typical eve of battle. It reminded me of the night before the Battle of Winterfell in Game of Thrones, which itself is a bit like, I thought, very much based on Shakespeare's Henry V, and it's the eve of Agincourt, where everybody, you go around and everybody's getting nerved up for battle, but they're trying to distract themselves and they're talking about their lives. I thought that was really well done. It had some great versions of different myths being retold, as well as teaching you quite a lot about people's history. So Sigrid tells her story, for example, and we hear all about Aedh, the poet, and slave, and how he came to be enslaved. He's an interesting character. I think it would be nice to talk about for a moment if we get time.
Oh, yes. Please do. I guess in just quickly highlight that particular episode, because that's when we first really get a visual of Odin, who, of course, I immediately called him out the moment he walks on into the encampment and everyone's saying, storyteller, storyteller, tell us a story. And like, he's a cloak, one eye, hasn't got a hat like Gandalf. But I mean, yes, it's just so visibly Odin. I'm like, how do these people not know it's Odin? How? And of course, he tells this tale of the two giants and the enchanted millstone and why there's salt in the sea. And you're like, okay, that's an interesting giant tale. And then everyone else has a story. So the giants tell about Loki enchanting a horse as a horse to make Sleipnir and that whole thing. And there's a great, of course, ongoing pun on kind of like enter Loki, and Loki enters, and then entering Loki in a very sexual way, because of course he becomes a mare to have sex with a stallion, and that kind of thing. But when Odin reveals himself at the end of the episode, when Sigrid's thinking about what if this happens, what if this doesn't, and he remarkably gives her back the spear that he has. I'm like, why don't you just walk off with the spear now, Odin? It'll solve so many problems. he kind of like reminds her that although those giant girls did get their freedom, they also died, which I think was a really clever way of saying, just so you know, if you come up against me, you might die. But yes, speaking of stories, as you mentioned, Caroline, Eagle the poet is a storyteller throughout a lot of these episodes, and he leaves after regaining his freedom and thus his own story, and he comes back after telling the story of Sigrid's attempt to topple the gods. So please do share what your thoughts are on Eagle the poet.
Well, he's obviously, his name is taken from the poet Eil Skallagrimson, one of the greatest poets in Old Norse literature. And so I quite perked up when he introduced himself. I thought, well, how Aedh-like is he going to be? Is he going to pluck people's eyes out and get very drunk and vomit in their faces and all the stuff that the actual Icelandic figure does? And he doesn't really, he's not as brutal as that, partly, of course, because he's got this slave status, and partly because he's one of those, I don't want to say tick boxes, but the show is really interested in diversity. When you gather together all of the band of Avengers, you've got women, you've got a dwarf, you've got the gay guy, you've got the leader is a woman, and you've got the Seid Cohn as well. You've got older women, which I thought was interesting. So Aedh tells about how he became enslaved by Leif killing his, how he was kind of cast out from the community because he was gay, and then getting killed and taken off by Leif. But also one of the things that's quite striking about him, I think, is that he's the kind of comedy person. He's the one with the wisecracks. He's the one who keeps his spirits up. And it struck me that he had quite a lot of the poet in The Witcher, Dandelion, that he's, and that I think has something to do as well with the depiction of Chaucer going back to A Knight's Tale. It's the poet as a kind of commentator. He doesn't fight particularly, but he's just kind of, he's there with a quip, and he's the one who's going to tell the story later too. And I thought he was really quite nicely done, because he has got, he can produce verse in a fairly plausible way.
Yeah, he did kind of echo a very kind of like very modern, normal, relatable experience and voice, I think, especially kind of like, why are we seeing this vulva, this wicked witch that supposedly eats her own children for Freya? Why are we going up against the gods? He asked the very kind of like most obvious questions that we as audience may be wondering, kind of like, why are they doing all these dangerous, crazy things? But I also liked that he had a little bit of cedar magic in him, and that he kind of carved runes and then cast a little bit of a magic spell, because of course cedar is a very feminine led or managed magic, and of course that then introduced the seed Kona, which is a vulva, and everyone knows them as a her. But then they reveal that they were actually born a boy, but their mother, I think their mother said, oh, she saw a woman's future for me, so I now wear my woman's clothes and keep the story going. So of course that introduces the whole transgender identity community and themes too, which I thought is interesting, because of course Odin supposedly, well, he gets teased by Loki in Loki's famous insults round at Njord's Hall down in the secret. I'm like, Odin, you wear women's clothes and you do women's magic kind of thing. And so that possibly might be a reference of linking that in as something, as well as kind of embracing all diversity and ethnicity as well. But yes, you mentioned about older women. Of course, Hervor, she is a very mature woman. She's probably the oldest female in the group, besides possibly the vulva. She has no unknown age. But she mentions having had three sons and having lost them in battle and wanting to join them as well, which I thought was a really interesting twist as the journey went on and as the kind of like the ramifications increased. She's kind of like, will I get to see my sons? If we topple the gods, what becomes of Valhalla? Where do we go? And then, of course, spoiler alert, she doesn't sadly get to go to Valhalla because she picks a cursed sword, which again, I think is a nice twist, maybe very loosely to the Sword of Tirfing. Well, that's what Hel says. She goes, oh, she can't go to Valhalla because she got a cursed sword, so I'm taking her. But don't worry, she's no pawn of the gods anymore. I'll look after it down with my undead friends kind of thing. So,
well, Tirfing was cursed.
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was cursed. She didn't die from the sword. She passed it to her sons, who then killed each other. Or one killed the other, I should say. But yes.
This is a kind of interesting development, though, isn't it? Because according to the traditional myth, if you die in battle and you're male, you're going to Valhalla. And everybody else is going down to the Hall of Hell, which is why Baldur ends up there, because he doesn't die in battle. And yet nobody in modern retellings, people are really a bit unhappy about that. And you find in quite a lot of games, for example, I think in Assassin's Creed, but you get it as early as the 1958 Vikings movie, the idea that if you really want to go to Valhalla and you die with a sword in your hand, off you can go, even if you weren't in battle. And you have the female protagonist in Assassin's Creed Valhalla going, I'm going to Valhalla. People are going to Valhalla in Vikings, the TV. Women are going to Valhalla in Vikings, the TV show. Even this kind of crazy polar bear that turns up in one of the side adventures of the bear's going to Valhalla. I mean, who isn't in Valhalla? Well, so the rules have really got bent around that. But one of the things in that book by Kate Hartfield, The Valkyrie, that we were talking about in Stavanger a bit, weren't we? You get an alternative setup where the Valkyries, who have been working for Odin, are now starting to work for Freya, who takes half the dead. And Freya is running a kind of independent post-death franchise there. And there's a kind of sense that that Freya's role becomes quite complex in this show, that she does have half the dead. She's got a say in this. She's got some influence over the Valkyries. And although they're still quite rule-bound, she and Hel are working together, and Heather's going to be okay. And I think the whole cursed weapon thing, Andvari did warn them all, to be fair.
Yes, he did.
But he didn't say how the curse would play out.
No, that is true. Do go read The Valkyrie by Kate Hartfield. It's a mind-blowing explanation of Valkyrie and Lon, of course, around the whole saga of the Volsungs with Brynhilde and Sigurd. It's very not Wagner's operatic cycle, which I quite found, even though I don't think I could quite watch the whole cycle. But yes.
Can I make a comment about the Valkyries?
Please do. Yes, please do.
I was so annoyed that they were naked and we get all these close-ups of their boobs.
And they had wings.
Oh, come on.
I don't get. They had wings. But yes.
I was like, do we really have to go to this, 15-year-old guy fantasy of what the Valkyries would look like? I'm like, they're war maidens.
It's a very Zack Snyder thing to do.
Very Zack Snyder. Yeah, there were a lot of boobs.
That is for sure.
Yeah. They had winged helmets of different styles and types, but I was struck by how distant they were from everything, even though they were literally hovering over the battlefield. They always kind of like beamed down, like in Star Trek, then beamed back out. Kind of like Sigurd was appealing to them very directly, kind of like, please take my friend, please take her. And they were just kind of like, not an emotion, not one word was said. And something like, who is giving their orders? How are they choosing? What? Again, I had questions more than answers from their kind of their role in this. But of course, that then, I guess, nicely links us back to Odin, who of course is typically seen as the commander-in-chief of the Valkyries, and he tells them, go get that one and that one and that one and that one. They give them a shopping list of dead people to go get, because Odin is presented in a very, very starkly different embodiment, I guess you could say, in that he's shown as having three aspects of himself: a king, a storyteller, and of course the wise, being that he sacrificed himself on a tree, which not many people of the Marvel fandom will know that he did hang himself on a tree to himself, stabbed himself, gave himself a gracious wound, and also learnt the runes at the same time.
I liked that depiction of Odin. I liked that they showed him that way. And then when the Sid Kona grabbed hold of memory and killed it, and then Odin started almost like he was glitching, it was like glitch Odin. And it was very interesting, I thought, to have that happen, to have him be, and then the way his voice sounded and like he was everywhere. I thought it was very interesting. I did not like the vision of Jesus.
That
completely jerked me right out of the story. I understood what they were trying to do. They were showing that Ragnarok is the end. People are going to stop worshiping you, and they're going to start worshiping this god. But just the church and the just him.
Yeah, it was the touch on the face. Down. I thought, why are they touching each other? Why?
It took me out of the world. So
because it did look to me. I thought, isn't that St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York?
It looked like that, yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely an American setup. Definitely.
Yeah. And
I'm surprised he wasn't freaking out about the cars driving around him more than the kind of like the new god that emerged flying down from, why he's hanging a tree and then suddenly he's seeing anyone else. But the thing that got me about that particular scene.
19th century view that. And in 19th century mythological treatments, what you get is the idea that it's Thor who is, of course you get that already in the sagas, that Thor is the big guy who is standing up against the white Christ who's being brought by the missionaries. And you have that in Longfellow, for example, Thor's challenge. He talks about how there's Thor stomping around in his chariot, waving his hammer and shouting and being a war god. But the gentle Galilean goes, Thor, no, the future does not belong to you. So this idea that this peaceful religion is going to displace the kind of warmongering of Old Norse religion is something that you did get in the 19th century. But what you had there with Odin hanging from his tree and Christ hanging from his was very much kind of modern scholarly speculation, I guess, going back to the idea of the hanged gods that you have in the Golden Bough. But also people have said, why doesn't Snorri Sturluson ever tell us about Odin hanging from the tree? It's in Havamál, it's in the Poetic Edda, but it's not in the Prose Edda. And people have suggested it's because Snorri thought about that myth and thought, there's only one hanged god in my world, and that's Christ. We're not going to suggest that Christ have those parallels. But the script writers picked up on that, I think. And that's how we end up with, oh, look, suddenly we're in New York. And I find that a bit jarring. I didn't mind. I wouldn't have minded having Christ and Odin kind of eyeballing each other like that. But that kind of vision of the future also suggests it was an American future. And that had to me a kind of, I don't know, touch of cultural imperialism, which the show has been quite good about avoiding with all of these Scandinavian actors.
Yes, because of course the whole terrain that we travel through this series is very much fantasy. It's not familiar, it's not quite Scandinavia, it's not quite England or Anglo-Saxons or anywhere in Europe. It's very much new fantasy terrain. It doesn't seem to...
But it's pretty Scandinavia, isn't it?
It is. I mean, we have the giant causeway literally lead them to the giant's land, which I thought was a really nice touch, actually. Although I just think that they kind of like they could summon it and de-summon it with a blast of a giant horn, which she had to leap up a tree. But going back to that scene with the Seedcona Ale and Odin, kind of like she says, no more looking back, High One, such is the cost of foresight. Because, of course, she's taken memory, so she's showing him the future, but he might not remember it now because she's taken memory, although kind of like he cradles memory like a newborn dove. But then she herself has an interesting twist in that Odin does kill her after seeing this, and Eagle gets to her just in time, and she says very dramatically, this was the last thing I saw of Eagle, and then she dies. But then she dramatically transforms into what Freya suggests is a new goddess, a mixture of Aesir and Vanir blood. But I'm not sure what she could be or who she might be representing that comes next, or indeed what she could be doing next in season two, because she seems very aloof of everything. She goes like, I know you, Aegil, but then I don't know you because I have no recollection of my mortal life.
That was another callback to the Lord of the Rings when Gandalf the Grey falls and he comes back and he's Gandalf the White. And he sees the others and he's like, I know you, but he's kind of not. And he's totally different now. He has more powers. And I could go on about all the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings.
I'm so glad I have you on because I haven't seen the Lord of the Rings films in many, many years. Over 10, if not 15, nearly 20. I'm that old. So I just, as much as I love the series, I just, but yes, it's interesting.
Well, I thought what was going on there actually was, and I'm not sure if there wasn't some reference to the myth earlier on, but in the Seeress's prophecy in Völuspá, we have this figure, Heiðr, who is burnt three times in the Hall of the Gods and comes back three times. And I thought that was what the Seedcona became at that point, that she'd been destroyed and she was unkillable. And we don't quite know. It looks as if Heiðr is, because she's quite an important figure in Joanne Harris's work. Testament of Loki Gospel of Loki, I think. That she's somebody who's kind of unkillable and a female principle and one with a kind of wisdom. Of course, in The Witch's Heart as well, that's Angurbolter is that unkillable figure too. So I thought it was making play with that. But I can't really for the life of me see why she was an Aesir Vanir mashup without having some kind of family connection that was clear.
Well, I think that's the one thing I didn't like about this series. Yes, because she had a connection to Freya. Freya, my wife, was useless. She'd given her gift to gut-weaving mortals, because, of course, the vulva uses the spell. And Seedcona uses lots of gut and intestines in all her magic. Wolf-riding witches, which was a nice twist to Angrimmode, because that's mentioned in the lore. Of the word past mother to daughter. Now, of course, in this case, we know Seedcona was born a boy, but they now identify as a girl. So it's interesting how it still channels along.
That's a good point, Caroline, about the entrails and the Valkyrie. That Irish tale where they saw the Valkyries in the hut and they're using the entrails as the thread and the skulls as the warp weights. And maybe that is a callback to that.
I'm sure that. I thought, I recognize that bit.
But yeah, I put in my notes, rather unfortunate and disappointing that they completely and utterly made Freya next to powerless when she really isn't, which is, I think, I hope those of you will agree, that she was quite powerful. You've already alluded that she had half the dead, as we know from other depictions, like in Crate Hatfield, some Valkyrie, and she does, she knows cedar magic, and yet for some reason in this universe, she gives it all up in order to bring peace to her tribe, the Vanir, and marries Odin, which again, there's no Frigg, no sign of Frigg. And yet she's there doing next, and she's really just kind of like a messenger between the Vanir and Loki, and that's about
it. But isn't she like a kind of sleeper agent?
Yeah.
In Asgard, that
possibly.
Yeah, that she's the Vanir insider who's been kind of, it's a little bit, it struck me as like when Theseus marries or takes Hippolyta, the queen of the Amazons, and as you get at the beginning of Midsummer Night's Dream, for example. And so you've got this couple who are married, but the wife has got power of her own, and she's kind of keeping it under wraps. She's pretty equivocal about the situation. And you can kind of see, I think, Freya sort of biding her time and kind of not minding too much being Mrs. Odin. Though we never really see enough of Odin to get a sense of what their relationship is like. But when she starts getting the call from the Vanir going, you know what, we're going to come for those guys, she's ready to open the gates there.
And could yet they she also steps in front of Thor when he's about to kill everyone after Balder's dramatic death, which is, again, was a twist I didn't actually see coming until it actually happened, because I didn't twig that the marriage wreath that Sigrid has was mistletoe until it was actually, oh yeah, it's just gone through Balder, that explains it. because she zooms down and actually holds Thor back, she actually proves physical strength. And then, of course, he breaks down in tears and they both Star Trek beam off to Valhalla, as Loki says it. Oh, that reminds me. The ships with the Einherjar are coming down from Valhalla. Why are they coming down from the sky? Why were they landing like stormtroopers on the battlefield? It made me laugh. I'm like, why are they doing this? It's a ruin of a perfectly good ship.
That was a choice. Well, and also you said they didn't mention Frigg, but maybe the storytellers are using that idea that Frigg and Freya are the same, and it's just they've just separated over the years, and that's why. But they don't mention Freya isn't in it at all, was he? I didn't see her brother.
There's a brief glimpse of Heimdall when Thor's. But there's that episode where he's got like that. He's had his night with that woman that I still can't get the name pronounced right. So I'm just going to say
some Andragia or whatever her name is.
Began with S.
Yeah.
I just know her as Defeat, Lady Defeat, Mistress Defeat in my notes, because Thor says, oh, Defeat. And he goes, I will.
Andragia.
Yeah.
Well done, Sasha. I cannot pronounce English at the best of times. I'm like, where is this character come from? Does she have any link at all to the Norse pantheon? Because I certainly haven't come across it before.
Well, she does.
really? Because
thanks to Wikipedia, which is not, of course, the best source, but it's the only place, and I Googled her, it's the only place I could find her. And she apparently turns up in a temple inscription from the 3rd century Netherlands.
Wow.
So she's right down from the very south of among the Germanic tribes there, but it's a Germanic name, and it's a feminine name, and the inscription says something that can be interpreted like, this is where we worship Sandrödiga. And then there's a lot of debate about what the name means. Is it sand, like sand, and rose meaning red, so the red sand one, or is it sand meaning derived from the word for true? So the true what? Something else. Who knows? So they've, I think, gone for a very abstract idea. But she does have a kind of genuine but old, much older name. And the same goes for Tiwaz, of course, who's the kind of very The Green Knight 1921 film, kind of very twiggy leader of the Vanir. And I thought he was quite derivative of that film. But his name, Tiwaz, is the older form of Tyr. And Tyr is, of course, one of the Aesir. So there's kind of ancient layer of names that the showrunners have picked up on to produce the characters that they need, but they can't get from the more canonical figures.
And speaking of like ancient callbacks, did anybody else notice when in the final battle, when Thor was riding in his chariot and was dragging Tiwaz's body behind the chariot?
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, just like Achilles in the Iliad.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, interesting little reference. Yeah.
I just remember thinking that's overkill, that. Like, he'd already like stamped him to death and made his point, and then was like, right, I'll drag him around as well.
I felt sorry for him because his body started climbing after the head had been chopped off and squished. I was like, oh, the body is wanting the head back, but the head is gone.
Yeah, well, it was the Green Knight, absolutely. Mm. I thought, does David Lowery know that they've stolen his Green Knight for this figure? It's really quite striking.
Shall we touch briefly on Andvari the Dwarf and, of course, the legend of Fafnir and the gold and not a very cursed ring, but they used that in a very different way in placing Fafnir's as kind of like Loki's minion of sorts. And guarding the apples, which they've claimed from the Bene. Again, there's no Idun looking after the apples. I've got a dragon instead.
But that's from Greek myth, of course. So that's the dragon that guards the golden apples of the Hesperides. It's one of the labors of Hercules. He has to go and get the golden apples from this garden at the far western end of the world and face off this dragon. And take the apple. I don't think he kills the dragon, actually. He just has to outwit it and take the apples.
Carol, there's a second call from country cousins, perhaps you could.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I better. Yeah. Sorry, I'm going to have to duck out for a minute.
That's fine. No worries. You go for it,
Carol. Okay, I'll be back in a sec.
No worries. It's all editable. All editable. So what did you two think of Edvari and Fafnir and all that jazz, so to speak?
Yeah, I liked that. I liked the way it was portrayed, and you know, coming back to what Caroline said before, like, they didn't technically kill Fafnir until Leif kind of makes a point of you know, chopping his head off and saying, you know, to Sigurd that, you know, is this what you want? I'll be what you want if you want.
Yeah, it was interesting. I liked how they described the dwarves as princes and as they're all being shape-shifting friends, because of course there was the heron and Varys the fish, and of course there was the other dwarf who was the otter. But of course,
Otter was his name.
Yes, Otter. Sorry, I should have known that really, because I have read it twice. But it was interesting that kind of like they all weaved into kind of like Loki stealing the treasure, and it's not the cursed ring, which is what most people remember from, of course, Wagner's opera and the Nibelungenlied. Well, he'd. Can never pronounce that word either. But the treasure that is cursed, Fafnir, of course, they made a good point. They're like, yeah, once you're a dragon, you can't really inherit your father's kingdom. So kind of like Loki wins and all these points and destroys a whole dwarven heritage, and there goes a kingdom without an heir.
It was an interesting choice, though, to leave Odin out of that story, because Odin was a part of that story, and wasn't there somebody else? There's like another god who every now and then, like, it's Odin's brother or somebody, and I can't remember. I wish I would have looked it up.
I can't remember either.
Sometimes shows up in stories, and I think he was one. There was the three of them, and then they got hungry, and that's why they killed the otter, and then that's when they ran into their father. I thought it was an interesting choice to leave Odin out of. I wonder if they just wanted to make Odin so much more mysterious that we don't see him really much.
I mean, there's a scene where like Thor's shouting at the top, kind of like, you've had your turn, you've had your huntsman, which I thought was a really interesting maybe twist on the wild hunt kind of thing that Odin goes on supposedly in the autumn time.
That hunt was very that was total Peter Jackson,
really.
When the Nazgul were chasing the hobbits, it was the music sounded like the Howard Shore score a little bit. As soon as I saw that, I went, oh my gosh, they're the Nazgul and they're chasing our heroes, only they're not hobbits and they're not helpless. But yeah, it was
even
very
mirrors for like you know, I think it's after there's a kid stood in the road as they drive past and he just chops them down rather than.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I thought that was, I was really puzzled. It's like if Odin sends these things, because we don't really see their faces.
They were, what were they called again? The Bulwurkers, I think.
Oh,
I wrote down Bulwurkers, and I.
That sounds right. I've
never heard that term before.
You will gladden his ravens, one absolutely epic episode title.
I think it is Bulwurker.
Yeah.
And wasn't it that same episode where after they got the Sayid Kona on their team?
Yeah, Bulwurks.
They were crossing some water and there were the women floating in the water. They had been like shunned as whores or something. And I thought, well, that's like the Dead Marshes where the hobbits, the fallen warriors who were in the water.
That was really interesting. I thought, is this harking back to a time before kind of like the Norse, when there was the Norse, when it was just Germanic tribes, where women might have had been more punished and persecuted for all sorts of reasons, because it looks like, oh, this is for where the women and the priestesses who spoke out had their tongues cut out and they were locked in. And of course, all the undead bodies, it's very much like an opposite version of sirens, or kind of like it's a very undead sirens, very much, because like they were just floating by, going woo. And then, of course, they all got animated when they challenged the gate. And even like the figure at the gate appeared to be female. In some regard, she had a very female voice, and I liked how they kind of like had death speak, even though it came up in subtitles like death speak. Blah, 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 blah. And then Loki has to spit into her mouth for anyone to understand. but yes, the Bulwurks were, I thought, really odd, because surely if people who worship Odin know these guys are Odin's guys, and yet they go around killing everyone, why would anyone worship Odin if they know that these guys can come round and just kill everyone for whatever Odin commands? Because like they do find the boy and his parents, like, oh yes, we will leave you to Odin and he will gladden his ravens and we'll be blessed and we'll be spared. I'm like, no. I mean, I've always believed that, kind of like, even Marvel doesn't really get this right, that Odin is probably more of a trickster in Loki, and that no one thinks that Odin is a trickster, but he is. He is more deceitful than Loki at times in a lot of the mythology. I mean, I remember reading one of the sagas where Odin pretends to be someone on the other side of a river, and he just hands a lovely insulting match with Thor for no reason.
He just likes to
fly around insults. And I'm like, why? What's the point? What kind of father figure are you? But yes.
Well, didn't he have like a... Didn't he have a contest between him and Frigg with or was it Freya? And they just went down and they just started messing around with these kings' lives, and they had no thought to anybody. I can't remember the story. Was it Frigg or was it Freya that he was doing that with? Anyway,
that's mentioned in your book. Well, I'll say the book that you're part of, Odin. I'm sure that's an introduction. I read it. They kind of like, they went down and they both adopted two princes that had a strainer ship. Odin says one, and they both say, oh, go forth and make yourselves kings. And I think it's Frigg's chosen one that does better, then Odin has to come back and remind his
bet
one.
They had.
Yeah, there's a twist in the tale.
They keep interfering more and more.
Yeah.
Right. They're just playing with the humans, like they're, you know, just like game pieces. And then there's the story of the king who wanted, like, he had, like, two wives and he wanted to choose the best one, so he told them they had to both brew him beer, and the one went to Odin to help her with her beer, and he spit in it, and the condition was that he got what was between the cauldron and him, and she was pregnant at the time, so he ended up claiming her son. So you can't trust Odin.
That's for sure.
And yet for all that scheming mechanics that we know from having read some of the canon lore and being more familiar with it than most modern day folks, it's interesting that they didn't make Odin so aloof and so remote. And like, he doesn't even show any command over the Valkyries, let alone his own sons. And we don't, of course, see many of them. We only see Thor, Balder, Heimdall briefly and Hodder very briefly at the end when he literally says, oh, look, it's mistletoe. And I'm like, yes, there's the connection. They finally put two and two together and got Hodder with mistletoe, but he didn't throw the dart, as it was in the lore. It's a spear in this case.
What did you all think of the way Baldur looked? I thought it was really interesting that he was gold and glowing.
I like that they went with like a literal Manhattan interpretation.
Yeah. Dr. Manhattan vibes, straight off Watchmen. That's what I was getting. Like, he's Dr. Manhattan, but golden. That's it. He's not radioactive, thankfully, but he's... But yeah, it was interesting. But although he had a little part and so did Sif, I thought their discussion, of course, kind of like in between this battle and... Sif saying, can you just please protect my husband? I know he's an idiot and he does all these nasty things, but he's only half my harvest, which I thought was a really bizarre phrase of describing her relationship with him. And she's kind of like, oh, he brings the rain and I bring the wheat kind of thing. I'm going to find the dialogue now because I thought that was just really, really well written.
I loved her hair. I loved how they did her hair. So.
Like glowing.
Mm-hmm. Long, glowing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Like she says, I am the grain goddess, he is the god of rain. But then Baldur says, when your love withered, so too did the world. And I'm like, what world are they speaking of? What withered? What effects, consequences, what happened?
Well, that's called the Ragnarok thing, isn't it? That the world is kind of running down because the twilight of the gods is coming. And if you think about those verses, you'd be expecting the great winter to come where nothing will grow at all. So I think it's that sense that the fertility of the world is under pressure.
Can I ask about the final scene?
Yeah, please do.
Okay, I have to admit that I thought the battle scenes were boring and I skipped some of it. It was just like battle, you know, fight for a while, and it just went back and forth. So I ended up getting kind of
did you
bored.
See the Sigurd skating on the shield like Legolas?
Oh no,
I might have battle?
I didn't. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and how many times was she going to be flying in the air with her spear? Anyway, that happened a lot.
The slow-mo thing. Yeah.
The slow-mo with her flying. And so why did... I didn't understand what was happening. I know why she's in Valhalla, but why Thor... I didn't quite get what was going on at the end between her and Thor in Valhalla.
Freya just beamed...
Was he dead? Like, did they kill him, or did they just go to Valhalla?
I think it's just basically his timeout room because, of course, he's just witnessed and been heartbroken over Baldur's death. Remarkably, we don't see him crying over his failed marriage, but we see him crying over Baldur.
Right? Yeah.
He seems very to know he was there. Did he? Like, he was kind of like aware he was there, but he was kind of like he remembered Sigrid, but he didn't like. He seemed a bit like kind of dead behind the eyes while he was in there.
Right, yeah.
But he also said something like, we've got unfinished business, haven't we?
Yes, I've got so it's kind of,
yeah, that's the pitch for season two, isn't it?
Yeah, right, he says there. We've been tossed and blown about by the whims of others, which I thought is yes, that's also very true, although it does also lay in his court because he started all this.
Yeah.
I was going to say.
he says, we both haunt the same hearth, and so begins the song of Sigrid. And then the doors close very dramatically and ominously, and we are left thinking, oh, what? Because it kind of makes sense that Thor does get to go to Valhalla. Nearly in every other iteration of Valhalla, all the gods can gather there. It's not just Odin, only in Odin's hall.
I read a book when Thor's in Valhalla. He's just there hanging out because that's a place to hang out.
Yeah.
If you like warriors.
Right, yeah, and he's...
But and actually, that closing door now, when she's on her own with no god killing weapon, because of course that's left down on the plains of mortality. Unless Loki, of course, is allowed back in, because of course, remarkably, he does take up weapons in this series. He does actually fight face to face with Thor, with Sigrid in partnership, albeit using Anvari's maces, which I thought, I wasn't sure if that was in good taste or in bad taste, that he killed the dwarf and then he gets the weapons.
Yeah.
But yes, I quite liked, quite liked how Sigrid challenged him, kind of like, you've made all your moves now, they know you're a traitor, can you at least get off your ass and come and join in the fray? Because it the battle scene was long. I think it was like 2 episodes, maybe?
Pretty well.
Yep, I think it started by the hammer, because that's when there's that really... I'm not sure if it's a good song or it's certainly a catchy song that suits kind of Thor's uplifted mood after having a good night with Sondra Liger and thinking, yeah, I can do all this. I can do it with a hammer.
Can't stop this.
Yes, can't stop this. Although kind of like, I did think kind of like, at least not playing kind of like stop hammer time.
That was too much noise.
kind of thing. But yes, they've left it very, very open-ended, and I'm not sure where they can go next, because surely they will net Loki back into Asgard. Odin's having an identity crisis. Balder's dead. Freya, she may prove to be the trump card in all this now.
I guess we don't Loki know. Did kill Sigrid. He's got that to his benefit.
Mm.
He can claim, you know, I was the one who killed her. So.
Yeah, I mean, Leif probably won't trust him again now. No one's going to trust him again. I mean, they can't all kill themselves and join it, because that's not how Valhalla and Valkyries work, it seems.
That goes with the lore, though. I mean, how many times does Loki do something that causes mischief and damage and death, and then they just let him back in to do it again until that final time where they finally have had enough of him? But, you know... Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. That's how all those gods should feel about Loki. I mean, at least in the in the stories, he's constantly doing something, and then they just he causes a problem, he fixes it, and then they just keep allowing him to come back in to do some cause another problem.
He is the fixer. I think that's the issue, isn't it? Because he's not, as far as we know, responsible for Thor's hammer being stolen in Thrymskvitha, but yet he's the fixer who gets Thor to get the hammer back. And so even though they have to put up with a certain amount of nonsense from Loki in order to have the fixer around, until the point where his complicity in the death of Baldur becomes such that they can't anymore. Mm-hmm. And you have that final break in Loki's quarrel, Lokasenna.
I'm not sure where they can go next, what myth they might adapt to resolve this issue of Sigrid versus Thor. Because she's
up a lot of the canon already, haven't they? So
I mean, they've killed a lot of the Vanir, even the beehive guy, which I thought was a really odd character to throw in and kind of like have a grieving flower giantess of sorts weeping over some dead bees. I'm really struck as to where they got all the giant animals from when they marched on Asgard. Like, there's a giant fox, a badger, a hare. There was all sorts of things going on. I guess the only thing they have is this new goddess that evolved from the seed Kona, because Eagle is out by the time Sigrid gets it, effectively. So they've got her out, but it's whether they can get... Yeah, it's unusual. They're really starting to go into unknown territory more than they already have done, I think.
I think
they might have... Sorry, go ahead.
That's
on.
All right. I just... I'd not come across Ulfa before. Is Ulfa prominent? Oh, or had they gosh. Made... Because I thought Peter Strummer's performance as him was good, but I'd really not come good. Across Ulfa before. Is there a prominent figure in Norse mythology? Or
he's just a representative berserker / wolf coat.
Right.
And but the fact that he can become a werewolf as well is a kind of folkloric development. You do have some werewolves in Icelandic literature, but they probably come from the European werewolf. They're not sort of endemic.
So
he's that kind of berserker. It's what you have in the Northman, when Amlot is part of that kind of cult band, and he's got a wolf skin and a bear pelt as well. So that's what he is. And so he's kind of still alive, isn't he, I think?
No, he gets killed. He gets killed. Hervor gets killed. Sorry, spoilers again.
Yeah. The Seidkon has turned into something else.
Yes, yeah. Eagles around. Yes.
So you've got Leif and Thera pretty well. Is that all that's left?
And there you go.
Is Eagle? Kind of. Eagle.
Eagles around. Eagle, Leif, the Seed Kona / New Goddess. Hervor gets it, the wolf gets it, and Varys gets it. So yeah, it's pretty
and
much.
And Thera.
Yeah.
Archer.
Yeah. Oh, yes, sorry, I forgot about her. Yes, she's.
Yeah, the new love interest, possibly.
Wasn't Ulfur a god? I mean, not in this story. I agree. He's just one of the representative of the Ulfhednar. But wasn't there a god named? I'm thinking of Uller. Uller is what I'm thinking. Yeah.
Well, I think what's happened here is that they obviously want season two, so they haven't had the definitive Ragnarok battle. But I think they're going to run into a kind of Game of Thrones problem, that they're not going to have enough storyline for another 8 episodes. And just where is it going to come from? Because they burnt through a whole lot of stuff here.
Yeah. Or else they're going to do what they did with House of the Dragon and just drag out season two.
I think as well, like, you've kind of told the, from my opinion anyway, like, Sigrid's kind of arc has come full circle in her revenge story. You know, she kind of got to the end and kind of, I guess not forgive Thor, but kind of went, oh, I'm not killing Thor for my revenge anymore. I'm doing it for other reasons on top of that. So I don't know
how
you kind of follow that revenge thread. Does she go back to just want him to kill him for that reason, or is she trying to reset the world?
Her speech at the end immediately made me think of Gladiator. I am a father of a murdered wife. I am a father of a murdered husband. I am the weeping. I am the last giant of the open hand. I am this. I am that. And oh yes, my name is Sigrid, and I am here to kill you.
Inigo Montoya.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't write it all down. I just put she refuses because, of course, Thor comes out with Sandra, whatever her name is. I'm just going to call her Sandra for short. It's just easier because Valda tries to talk sense into Thor not killing everyone like he did before, although Thor is outraged at Valda for having said, like, you told me I'd killed everyone, and Valda goes, yes, you killed all the giants, you didn't clarify you were mainly humans as well. But kind of like she says, kind of like, oh, you can walk home with me, but at least you'll walk home meaning you'll be alive, kind of thing, with the whole white shield. And I've just put she refuses and gives him a speech worthy of Gladiator in defiance. And that's when Thor realizes actually he was the one Balder prevented him from killing outright. And Heimdall and Hodder rush to Balder's side, and it's Hodder that reveals the mistletoe sprig. Loki smirks and vanishes. So Loki. But thinking of Loki, actually, the only other way they might develop this further is if they go and bring Loki more to the fore. Because, of course, in Ragnarok, Loki goes and gets a shipload of undead from Hell, made of nails, and sails forth and attacks Asgard. So maybe they're kind of like they've gone down the route of challenging the gods head on. Maybe they need to kind of like have their own army of sorts and not the veneer lost. Let's go get another army. Come on, daughter Hell, give me all your folks and we'll go and forth on a ship. Because that's another way they can maybe go.
I thought it was interesting that they didn't really go into the prophecy of Fenrir and Odin much as well. Like Fenrir was kind of, you know, it was about Jormungandr and Hel, but Fenrir wasn't really prominent in the story, so I don't know, maybe they explore.
No, yeah, he's only flashed twice, once when he's a pup and in the scene when Odin gets his great foresight at great cost, and he sees Jormungandr kill Thor, and I think he then sees a giant wolf lunge towards him, if not kill him, or at least just use the giant wolf literally within the mountains. But that's all we see of Fenrir, although I did find the proportion between the chains and the giant blue eyes a bit too out of proportion. It seemed too much. So yes, there is a Fenrir hiding around, and of course there's Hel and her army with the undead ship.
Still doesn't sound like 8 episodes to me, but hey.
Yeah. It is. I think we've covered everything. So thank you very much, Caroline.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sasha and Kim. It's been a really interesting discussion. I know we've covered lots and I've still got lots more notes. And I really appreciate all your insight into the Lord of the Rings influence. It's a new way of seeing it. I will now watch Lord of the Rings, then rewatch the series and see all the parallels you have.
you know, Tolkien was inspired by Norse mythology and the sagas and stuff. So it makes sense that then other people are then inspired by Tolkien. Just kind of, it's just a big circle.
Yeah. So.
Well, I really appreciate you joining me for this episode. Thank you, Sasha. Welcome to Valhalla. My little
thanks for having me.
I'm looking forward to having you on again soon to talk about your Berserker TTRPG, which is the Mork Porg or Mork Borg. I can never get that.
Yeah.
I can never get that name right either.
I think it's Merkberg, maybe.
Maybe. But they're rules that I've not come across before, so I'm looking forward to them. And of course, Kim, thank you for coming in. Please do go check out her podcast. I have got your book, your short story collection about Odin, on my shelf. It is a slow read, but I will get there. And I'm looking forward to letting you know what I thought to your short story, I'm sure.
And my books are under K.S. Barton. I don't know why I put him in my box.
Don't worry, it's all good. But thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, it was fun.
I appreciate your time. Hope you all, listeners and viewers, can join me next time, because in March we have Mr. Ian Stewart Sharp of the Vikingverse comics, books and TTPRG and podcast galore. So we have lots to talk to him about. Thank you for listening and watching wherever you are. Thank you very much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed the discussions between my special guests and myself. Please do check out the episode blurb for links to their works and websites. If you liked this episode, let me know by giving it a thumbs up. Let me know if you learned something new in the comments. And of course, click subscribe to Valhalla Conversations wherever you are listening or watching. This podcast can be watched on YouTube and YouTube Music. And it can also be listened to on Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, and on RSS.com. We hope you can join us in Valhalla again soon for more conversations.